This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, the Supreme Court heard arguments in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, a case which could have sweeping implications for the war on terror. Salim Hamdan, once Osama bin Laden's driver, was captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan in 2001 and later transferred to the prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Bush administration wants to try him before a military commission, a system that was established by the president to try suspected terrorists after 9/11. Lawyers for Hamdan argue that the president exceeded his powers and that the military tribunal system violates their client's rights. It's a complicated case that tests executive power in time of war and whether the Geneva Conventions apply to the men held at Guantanamo Bay. The case became even more complicated late last year when Congress passed the Detainee Treatment Act, which strips U.S. courts of the right to review cases brought by detainees. The justices heard arguments on that issue as well, and in an indication of their belief of public interest in this important case, they decided to release same-day audio recordings of the proceedings. Shortly after Hamdan's lawyer, Neil Katyal, began, the newest justice, Samuel Alito, interrupted to ask why the court should hear this case now, before the trial, when judicial review usually comes after a decision.
In criminal litigation, review after the final decision is the general rule. There generally is not any interlocutory appeal. And what you say could happen in any criminal case if you assume bad faith on the part of the people who are responsible for making the decisions along the way. They could delay indefinitely and postpone the entry of a final decision.
Justice Alito, if this were a final, if this were like a criminal proceeding, we wouldn't be here. The whole point of this is to say we're challenging the lawfulness of the tribunal itself. This isn't a challenge to some decision that a court makes. This is a challenge to the court itself. And that's why it's different than the ordinary criminal context that you're positing. In the ordinary criminal context you're positing, and I'm thinking of a case like Schlesinger versus Councilman, a court-martial case, what the court has said is that it's the predicate for abstention is the idea that Congress has fairly balanced the rights of both sides, an independent branch, and has made certain determinations. Here, none of that has happened. It's all been made by the executive. And the difference is crucial in military justice, because as Justice Kennedy said for the court in Loving, the framers harbored a deep distrust of military tribunals. And the thing that makes it different than the ordinary criminal context, the thing that, as this court said, stops military justice from being lawless, is the Congress of the United States setting clear limits on the use of military justice. Now, if those limits had been observed, if the military commission complied with the rules of courts martial, we wouldn't be here. Our whole point is that they don't, and that it falls outside of the well-recognized abstention exception for courts martial cases.
An excerpt from today's arguments before the United States Supreme Court. You heard Neil Katyal, Mr. Hamdan's lawyer, and earlier Justice Samuel Alito. We're going to take your questions about this case and its implications later in the program. But first, let's bring in David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, who was at the court today. He joins us here in Studio 3A. David, always nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil.
Now, listening to that argument, this whole jurisdiction issue and the legitimacy of the court, that was really a lot of the thrust of the exchanges between the justices and Mr. Hamdan's lawyer when it was his turn to speak.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The argument sort of started slow, and as the Bush administration's lawyer stepped up after about 45 minutes, Paul Clement, it got more heated. And I was surprised at how at least five of the justices seemed very troubled by the Bush administration's argument. They seemed troubled and really offended that Congress would have tried to take away their power to decide this case. One of the historic phrases is, you know, suspending the writ of habeas corpus. That's something you don't want to do. It hadn't been done since the Civil War. And they said Congress seemed to be doing that here, and we're not going to, you know, sort of accept that or tolerate it. They also seemed offended, I think, by the notion that the Bush administration sort of made up the rules as they went along here. These are justices who really think the law is a set of rules that are sort of laid out in advance and everybody has to follow the rules. You don't make up the rules in the middle of the procedure. And there was a tone of a lot of the questions that this is sort of a made-up procedure where the president gets to decide what's the crimes. He sort of makes the laws, he picks the prosecutor, he picks the judge, he picks the jury, and he gets to review the case afterwards. So it's too much presidential power.
That was Mr. Katyal's argument, that this court is not independent from the executive. In fact, it is a creature of the executive.
That's right. And Neil Katyal made this argument, and for most of the time, the justices sat and listened quietly, which is, in the Supreme Court's actually a good thing. When they just sit and listen to you make your points, that's good news. It's when they go after you, every statement you make. And Paul Clement is the one who really got the rough grilling today.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what he had to face. This is an exchange between the Solicitor General, Paul Clement, and Justice Breyer, who gets to the issue of jurisdiction of the courts.
How is what you're arguing consistent with the language I quoted? And two, how could it, if we accepted your interpretation, possibly avoid the most terribly difficult and important constitutional question of whether Congress can constitutionally deprive this court of jurisdiction in habeas cases?
Well, Justice Breyer, let me answer both pieces of that. I certainly think that such standards and procedures to reach the final decision is consistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States. There was a reference to the first military order. I believe there's also a reference to any other subsequent orders implementing that. All of that together implements the November 13th order. So I would think that it is very easy to read this language to allow any challenge that is being brought here, with the possible exception of the treaty challenge. And I think the language is capacious enough, if the treaty challenge is what you thought was very important, the D.C. Circuit, at the end of the day, could decide whether or not there was a requirement that the treaty challenge be brought.
General Clement, if you can.
And that we just heard Justice Ginsburg there a little bit at the end. And David Savage, the justices, as you're suggesting, really challenged the Solicitor General, not only on the substance of the case, but also on this whole issue of jurisdiction.
That's right. There's two big questions here in this case. First of all, does the Supreme Court still have the jurisdiction to hear this case? And secondly, are these tribunals unconstitutional the way they are set up? It seemed to me clear that five of them were inclined to say, yes, the court has jurisdiction. Congress cannot just casually suspend the habeas corpus. And they also seem, five of them seem troubled by, as I say, the sort of made-up quality of these military trials.
One of the issues that came up was whether, in fact, the crime with which Mr. Hamdan is charged, and that is conspiracy, whether he can be charged with that under the laws of war.
Yes, Neil Katyal consistently made the argument that conspiracy is not a war crime around the world because, in a sense, it's too broad and too vague. In other words, everybody on the other side is sort of conspiring against you. So if conspiracy alone is a war crime, then everybody on the other side is a war criminal. And so he said, the Bush administration says conspiracy alone is a crime. It's not a war crime. And you, the Supreme Court, ought to reverse the government on that issue, among others.
Mm-hmm. And we learned last week that the Bush administration will prohibit statements made under torture from military commissions at Guantanamo Bay. The Wall Street Journal indicated that could work to the White House's advantage in this Hamdan case. Did that come up at all today?
Yes, it was mentioned several times, but it sort of in the context of that the rules are changing. You know, you wouldn't think that a system that's now 4.5 years old, that they would be changing rules on the eve of the argument in the Supreme Court. I think it has the unintended effect of sort of adding to the sense that this is sort of, we make it up as we go along.
Mm-hmm. Just a point of clarification, it's been 4.5 years. Have any of these military commissions met? Have any of these trials gone ahead?
No. This is really the first one. When the president's people announced this in November of 2001, part of the argument was that these would be quicker and efficient for picking up all these al-Qaeda people and trying them. 4.5 years into it, they haven't actually gone forward with one of the trials. So we don't really know how it's going to work. And the question here is whether the Supreme Court's going to stop it before it even starts.
Mm-hmm. Another point of clarification. The new Chief Justice, John Roberts, was recused himself from this case because he was, at the time this case came up through the lower courts on the D.C. Circuit Court, he was a member of that court. So he heard it in that context, so the procedure is you can't hear it twice, so he wasn't sitting today. There was also a challenge to Justice Scalia, who made some what some might regard as intemperate remarks on this issue in Switzerland the other day, and a group of former generals, I think, filed an appeal to him to recuse himself from this case.
He was there, and he's not recused. He's just going to participate. I don't know exactly what Scalia's words can be interpreted different ways. He might have been talking about the issue that was decided 2 years ago, which is whether the detainees have any claim in court. But nonetheless, he was there. His views are pretty clear. He's going to side with the government in this case. He's not going to step aside.
Mm-hmm. What makes this case so important?
Well, I think it's because it's sort of a great test of the president's power in the wartime, that all along, since 9/11, President Bush and his lawyers have said the president is the commander-in-chief, and he basically has enormous power when we're in something called war, including creating a system to punish people. And the courts in the very past have been very skeptical of the idea, somebody mentioned it in the argument, is military justice, of letting that go too far. Steve Breyer said in this argument that if we uphold this, why not if the government picks up somebody in Toledo and says, we think you're an enemy combatant, we're going to try you in a secret military court. Well, we would all think, well, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But his point is, if we say this is okay, the president and Don Rumsfeld can sort of make up this system, what's the limit? What's the boundary? So I think their concern is this is a situation where the president is claiming a lot of power, and the courts want to say, is this really law, or is this going too far? Is this sort of the chief executive sort of making the rules as he goes along?
David Savage of the Los Angeles Times, stay with us if you will. We're going to take a short break and come back with more on the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, a case argued before the Supreme Court earlier today. We'll hear more tape from the arguments and conversation with David Savage, plus lawyers on both sides of this case. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're focusing today on a case heard before the Supreme Court earlier today, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. But this news update, Federal Reserve officials meeting for the first time under the new chief of Ben Bernanke, lifted U.S. interest rates today for a 15th straight time and said further moves may be needed to keep inflation at bay. As widely expected, the U.S. Central Bank's rate-setting Federal Open Market Committee voted unanimously to raise the benchmark federal funds rate 0.25 percentage point to 4.75%, the highest level since April 2001, and that from the Associated Press. And stay tuned to NPR News later today for more on that development and the on the Federal Reserve. We're talking today about the constitutionality of military tribunals or commissions. It's the issue in the heart of Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. The case was argued before the Supreme Court this morning. We're listening to excerpts from the arguments with David Savage, who's the Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And David, let me ask you, the Geneva Conventions, which the United States ratified, these were revised after the Second World War. The United States ratified them in 1955, I believe, and they're part of U.S. law. They're passed into law as well as ratified by the United States Senate. Did the court hear a lot of discussion as to whether the Geneva Conventions apply, the Bush administrations say they don't, to the enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay?
Well, several of the justices seem to suggest that they do apply or they should apply. They wanted to know, you know, on the one hand, the government is saying, this is war, we're dealing with the laws of war. And Justice Souter, among others, said, well, then why not the Geneva Convention? Why would the Geneva Convention here? And what the Geneva Convention basically says, if you're going to try prisoners from the other side, you can try them for war criminals, but you have to try them under the procedures you try your own soldiers. So the notion is, if the Geneva Convention applies, all that Hamdan would get was a sort of court-martial procedure.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically all this case in the end is about, is that his lawyers are saying, yes, you can charge him with a crime. Just try him under the court-martial procedures. And several of the justices picked up on the Geneva Convention point to really say, look, if you're going to say we're in a war, laws of war apply, why not follow Geneva Convention and give him a trial under the court-martial procedure?
Paul Clement, the Solicitor General, argued that going back to the Revolutionary War, the case of Major André, people who were captured out of uniform are not given that privilege.
Well, yes, that's right. There's a lot of historical argument here as to what is and is not the common practice. And Paul Clement and the administration sort of made the point is, you know, at one time, the General Washington could have just taken a spy out and have him shot. So we've actually made a lot of progress since then. We're at least giving Hamdan a real trial, mm-hmm. even if the rules are sort of made up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. When will this case be decided?
Well, I assume in June. It usually takes several months when the court is divided to get out an opinion. The one caveat, though, is that you mentioned earlier, Neil, is that John Roberts is out of this court, so there's always a possibility of a 4-4 split. If they meet later this week and there is a 4-4 split, they may issue an order next week saying we're evenly divided and we can't decide this case.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like there were 5 to rule against the government, however.
Let's listen to one more excerpt from the arguments. This is underlining some of the key moments in this case, key issues. This is another exchange between Justice Stephen Breyer and Solicitor General Paul Clement.
I take their argument as saying, look, you want to try a war crime. You want to say this is a war crimes tribunal. One, this is not a war, at least not an ordinary war. Two, it's not a war crime, because that doesn't fall under international law. And three, it's not a war crime tribunal or commission, because no emergency, not on the battlefield, civil courts are open, there is no military commander asking for it. It's not in any of those in other respects like past history. And if the president can do this, well, then he can set up commissions to go to Toledo and in Toledo pick up an alien and not have any trial at all except before that special commission. I've tried to summarize a whole bunch of points for you to get at as you wish.
Well, let me try to hit a couple of highlights.
I'll be interested in your answer if you can get it out.
Let me try to hit a couple of highlights. This is much more of a call for military commissions and a real war than certainly the use of military commissions against the Medoc Indians or any number of other instances in which the president has availed himself of this authority in the past. I think the events of 9/11 speak to the fact that this is a war where the laws of war are involved. As to whether or not the law of war encompasses the crime of conspiracy to violate the laws of war, we think that is clearly established. That is something that the United States treated as a valid war crime in the Civil War. That is something that the United States treated as a valid war crime in World War II. I would invite you, as to the former, to look at Winthrop's treatise, page 839, note 5. He makes it very clear that those conspiracies are not just conspiracies of municipal law, what he called of the first class, but they included the second class, which are classic war crimes.
That, another exchange in the Supreme Court this morning. Solicitor General Paul Clement there, and earlier you heard Associate Justice Stephen Breyer. David Savage will be back with us a little bit later in the program, and we're going to get to your calls later in the program as well, but we wanted to hear from advocates on both sides. Joining us is Joe McMillan, legal counsel for Salim Hamdan and an attorney with Perkins Coie in Seattle. Also with us, Andrew McBride, a partner with the law firm Wiley, Ryan, and Fielding, who filed a brief on behalf of Attorneys General Richard Thornburg, William Barr, and Edward Meese in support of the Bush administration's position. He's with us by phone from his office in Washington, and Joe McMillan is here with us in Studio 3A. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Joe McMillan, why don't we start with you? I think you were in court this morning. What did you hear that most interested you?
Well, what I heard that most interested me, I think, first was the extraordinary interest of the justices in the jurisdictional question
mm-hmm.
that was posed by the Detainee Treatment Act passed by Congress in late December of last year. And I think, as Mr. Savage indicated, there was very considerable interest on the part of the court as to whether or not Congress indeed intended to strip the court of jurisdiction over a pending case, which would be a fairly extraordinary action, and I think it was Justice Ginsburg pointed out, had not in fact occurred since the the 1860s. So there was quite a bit of questioning of the Solicitor General in connection with the intent of Congress in that statute. And in fact, Justice Souter and others on the court went farther to say that, in fact, if we interpret the Detainee Treatment Act the way the government suggests, does that not affect an unconstitutional suspension of the writ of habeas corpus? Mm-hmm. And some, I think, of the most, emotional portions of the argument related to the stature of the great writ in the entire Anglo-American legal tradition, and that certainly the government couldn't be suggesting that Congress inadvertently intended to suspend the writ.
Andrew McBride, as Joe McMillan was just saying, this is an important issue for the justices today.
Oh, yes, I think so. I think it's pretty clear that the argument the United States made that the Detainee Treatment Act had mooted this case and stripped the court of jurisdiction is not going to be successful, and that the court is going to say either the Detainee Treatment Act is not retroactive and doesn't apply to Mr. Hamdan's case, and or, as it has in the past, we are going to be very wary of reading any statute to completely strip anyone of the ability to file writ of habeas corpus to challenge the jurisdiction or the procedures of a body that could administer a sentence of years of imprisonment or even the death penalty. So I would have to agree that on that first jurisdictional argument, which was injected into the case by the passage of the Detainee Treatment Act in December of 2005, I think the government is going to quote-unquote lose. The court will find that there is jurisdiction to hear this case and will get to the larger issues upon which it originally granted certiorari.
And on that, Andrew McBride, and again, you filed a brief on behalf of three attorneys general on support of the administration's position. What about that substance of the case, the president's right to establish set of military tribunals independent of the judiciary system?
Well, I'd have to say it was a tough 90 minutes for Mr. Clement, and I thought he did a good job. The good news for the United States is I don't think there is any dispute, and I think they will find five, perhaps six votes for the proposition that the president does indeed have the authority, either as commander-in-chief under Article 2 of the Constitution, and or in this case under the congressional authorization to use military force passed after 9/11, to use military commissions, and that they are part of the commander-in-chief's prosecution of the war, much in the same way that the president can decide to use a submarine or a bunker buster, that a military commission is part of really accomplishing two things. One, deterring the enemy from violation of the laws of war, and telling our troops, essentially bucking up the morale of our troops by saying, if the enemy violates the laws of war, fires upon you under a flag of truce, we will punish them. So on the power issue, I don't think there's any dispute. I do think, and I would have to say, the administration appears to be in trouble over procedure and whether or not these military commissions comply with the Uniform Code of Military Justice and or with the Geneva Convention. And Justice Kennedy, who appears to be a key swing vote on what, as Mr. Savage pointed out, is an eight-member court with the Chief Justice recused, appeared to me to be extremely concerned about prosecutions under the laws of war that, in his view, did not comport with the laws of war. So I think we may see an opinion of five, perhaps, that rejects the jurisdictional argument, affirms the president's general authority, but perhaps says that these particular commissions do not have sufficient protections, such as defendant presence throughout the proceedings and other protections that are necessary under either Geneva or under the statute, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's my guess.
Joe McMillan, and again, a legal counsel for Salim Hamdan, that would, if Andrew McBride is right, that puts us all back to square one, doesn't it?
Well, it may well put us back to square one, and in fact, that in some respects is what our case was all about. It was, I think Mr. McBride put it very well, which is if the administration is indeed going to try this individual for a war crime under the laws of war, which is, after all, what a military commission is designed to do, then our position is simply it must itself comply with the laws of war. And the Supreme Court, I won't venture a guess on how it will come out on this issue, but we've argued to the court that it should require that the laws of war be applied, the protections of the laws of war, as well as the penalties of the laws of war. And in fact, Congress has required that in one of the statutes of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, in which it indicated that military commissions only have jurisdiction to try offenders or offenses triable by commission under the laws of war. And our client is not an offender. The charge of conspiracy is not an offense.
Now, that, on that last point, I would have to disagree. First of all, I think Mr. McMillan's a very modest man. I think he had a very good day in front of the court and put forth his argument with great force. And all I was doing was paraphrasing his argument, not agreeing with it. On the last point, I don't think he's going to win on that point. I do think the Solicitor General was right that conspiracy to violate the laws of war is a charge that is cognizable in a military tribunal, and I think the Supreme Court held that in Kieran. I think the Nuremberg trials themselves were officially military commissions, and there were charges of conspiracy there. So I think on that point, Mr. McMillan is not likely to prevail, although I think he's correct when he's, because I was not an advocate in the case, it's easier for me than for Mr. McMillan to make predictions. So I will. I think Mr. McMillan had a very good day on the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Convention, better than I ever would have predicted in terms of Justice Kennedy in particular, and some of Justice Breyer's pointed questions and about enforceability of those two as against the presidential directive, Military Order Number 1, establishing the military commissions and what their procedures are.
I need to interrupt to remind listeners that if they'd like to get into this conversation, we're going to start taking questions in a few minutes' time, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation.
I think on the point that a conspiracy to violate the laws of war is not cognizable in a military commission, I think there Mr. McMillan is wrong, and I think the court might disagree with him in the sense that, for instance, many of the Japanese who attacked Pearl Harbor, an unprovoked attack, were tried for conspiracy to violate the laws of war. As a matter of fact, I think Major Andre, the British spy who was hung by a military commissioned by General George Washington, was charged with conspiracy to spy along with Benedict Arnold to obtain the plans of West Point for the British Army during the Revolutionary War. So I think there's good historical precedent, and I think Kieran provides Supreme Court precedent for the proposition that conspiracy to violate the laws of war is a charge that could be tried in a military commission.
Obviously, Major Andre, before there was a constitution, much less a Geneva Convention. And Joe McMillan, let me get back to you on that point. The administration has held all along the Geneva Convention does not apply to these unconventional warriors, these enemy combatants. Is that an issue you think the court is going to address in this case?
The court may well address it. There were some questions from the bench today about the Geneva Convention. The position that we argued to the court was, and it didn't come up so much in oral argument as was submitted in the briefing, that this was a capture of an individual in the context of an armed conflict between two members of the Geneva Convention, the United States and Afghanistan. He was apprehended in Afghanistan in November of 2001. And in that context, the longstanding practice of the United States ever since the ratification of the Geneva Convention in the 1950s has been that in that context, if someone claims the protections of the Geneva Conventions, they are afforded POW status until an Article 5 hearing makes a determination of whether they deserve that status. Mm-hmm. And that's all we're asking with respect to the Geneva Conventions. And in fact, Justice Souter was quite pointed in his questioning on that matter.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Joe McMillan here with us in Studio 3A, a legal counsel for Salim Hamdan in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. Thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Andrew McBride there on the telephone. We appreciate your time today, sir.
Thank you very much.
Andrew McBride filed a brief on behalf of three attorneys general in support of the White House position in this case. When we come back from a short break, more of your questions. Well, in fact, you get a chance to join the conversation. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about the case of Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and what a Supreme Court decision in that case could mean for the future of America's war on terror. If you have questions and thoughts on the trial, on the case, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Still with us is David Savage, legal correspondent and Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And joining us now from a studio at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, is Scott Silliman. He teaches law at Duke, a former lawyer with the Air Force. Very good of you to be with us today.
Thanks, Neil. Pleasure to be with you.
And I wanted to ask you about the question of the legality of tribunals we heard references all the way back to the Revolutionary War today, and, of course, more recent cases going back to the Second World War.
That's correct, Neil, and I think that's probably one of the arguments the government will win in this case. It is clear that the president, either under his authority as commander-in-chief under the Constitution or Congress's grant of authority and the authorization for the use of military force, I think it's clear that the commissions have a lawful predicate. So that's one the government should win. But the court, as your commentators have already suggested, mm-hmm. is clearly closely divided on these other questions as far as the applicability of the Geneva Conventions, the procedures that should be involved in these. And those are very close issues in which even the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia split.
Mm-hmm. But you think the military commissions will be upheld even despite the arguments that these are independent of the regular judiciary system without access to the federal courts, without review from anyone outside of the executive branch?
Well, I think, again, the argument was this is the way Congress set it up. Interestingly, up until 1983, Neil, even the court-martial process, there was no direct appeal to the United States Supreme Court. So Congress set up an independent system under Article 1 of the Constitution. I think the real issue is here the court is not going to say that the president does not have the authority and rule out the use of all military commissions. I think they will work within the commission system. I think a very crucial point is the applicability of the Geneva Conventions, not so much whether these individuals are prisoners of war. I think an argument is that al-Qaeda is not. But as Senior Justice Williams said in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, common Article 3, which sets a baseline for treatment and court treatment, may apply, and that's something I think this court's going to be looking at.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. Again, 800-989-8255. We'll begin with Chuck. Chuck's calling from San Francisco.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
This seems like a perfect example of what I find very frustrating about the contradictions in the way we've been prosecuting the war on terror, because many people, including the president himself, have argued that the war on terror is really against an ideology or a movement, and therefore actions like these military tribunals really undermine our ability to mount a war against an ideology, because they make us look like hypocrites. They make us look very morally flexible on very basic principles that are supposedly at the foundation of the values and the democratic institutions that we're trying to promote. Things, you know, like habeas corpus and no cruel and unusual punishment and individual liberties and the rule of law and, you know, a democratic system of checks and balances. All of these things are the sorts of things that we're supposed to be promoting and the sorts of things that the ideology we're fighting is supposed to be against. And when we look morally flexible on these basic principles, it undermines our ability to oppose this ideology.
David Savage, at some point in the argument, I think it was Neil Katyal, the lawyer for Mr. Hamdan, was arguing that the commissions did not meet the basic minimum standards for decent treatment that were set out in international law.
Yes, that's right. I mean, as he said several times, that they were sort of rules that were made up. I think the caller's point's a good one, is that from overseas, this looks like we've taken a group of men who are supposedly picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan and put them in this sort of secret confinement in Guantanamo with, for months and years, no legal procedures at all. That doesn't, I think that for people outside the United States, it looks like we can talk about the rule of law and following fair procedures, but in fact, we're not willing to do it with people like this, people who are being held by the United States. So it sort of undercuts our image around the world.
And Scott Silliman, that goes back to the idea of the Geneva Convention's not applying.
Well, that's true, Neil. And again, I think what David just said reaffirmed my point about Common Article 3. There are some fundamental threshold requirements that we must meet. However, in response to Chuck's question, remember, most of these people, we are told, were picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And so there's no question that a military commander has the authority, even under common international law, to prosecute those of the enemy who violate the laws of war. Again, that's the only jurisdiction mm-hmm. here. The real issue is, and the point that David's raising is, how we do this. Do we do this in a perceived fair way, in a court-martial type of procedure, or do we make up the rules? And, of course, that's what the court was very concerned about this morning.
Mm-hmm. But, go ahead, Chuck.
I also wonder if, given the nature of terrorist organizations, which is to say they're divided up into small cells so that no single individual can really compromise the whole organization, if we even need to go to these extremes, given that I think they do undermine our credibility in a very crucial way, and in a way that makes it a lot harder to achieve an ultimate advances in defeating this ideology. Is there a legal justification if you kind of have a smart enough lawyer, but are we really advancing our own cause most effectively by doing this?
Okay, Chuck. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's turn to Dave. Dave's calling us from Sun Valley, Idaho.
Hello.
Hi, Dave.
How are you? Okay, my question is simple. Doesn't it matter that Congress has not officially declared war, and why? And I guess I'll take my answer off since I'm flipping burgers at work.
Okay, Dave. Good. Stay with it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Scott Silliman, the United States has not declared war since December 8th, 1941.
That's correct, Neil. And in direct response to Dave, no, it doesn't make a difference. The courts of the land, including the United States Supreme Court, have recognized that this country can be in a recognized state of armed conflict without a declaration of war. And so that is kind of a red herring. It doesn't have any effect on the argument. The question is, are the tools that the president has claimed he has the authority to use, are they legally predicated, and do they meet fundamental minimum standards according to the Geneva Convention? And that's what the court is really wrestling with in this case. And one other thing, Neil, going back to something that that David raised, which I think is very, very significant, how the court decides this case in the context of a military commission will definitely spill over into the views on how much authority the president has in other aspects of his fight against the war on terrorism, whether it be surveillance domestically, whether it be authorizing the CIA to do things. This case is a watershed case dealing with the ultimate authority of the president in the war on terrorism, and we need law in this area.
And I should correct myself before the emails come pouring in. I think later that same month, in December 1941, the United States declared war on Germany and Italy, too. So, all right, I sit corrected. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Israel. Israel's calling us from Turlock, California.
How you doing today, gentlemen?
Very well, thank you.
I totally believe that these military tribunals are necessary, and they are legal. It's a military matter, and it started since 9/11, and I think they should be carried out as they're supposed to be, and that's just my belief. I think that there's way too many politics involved. I think they should just let us do what we do.
Are you in the military, sir?
Yes, I am. I am a sergeant, and I served in Abu Ghraib prison from 03 to 04. So I've been there firsthand, and I understand the proceedings, and I understand that they should be carried out.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. The case was made, I think, by the Solicitor General, Paul Clement, Scott Silliman, that this does, in fact, affect morale of soldiers in the field.
Well, it definitely does, Neil. Again, we're talking about the president saying we are in a war, and I think we will be continually reminded that we're in a war for at least the next 2 years. Remember that the government's argument through Paul Clement is basically that when we are at a time of war, the president must be given great deference and given the authority to fight the war as the commander-in-chief, and that's their argument. If, in fact, we are at war, and the court is going to have to wrestle with this implicit question, then the president should be accorded those tools. The question is, should there be some legal constraints, or has Congress restrained the president either through the Uniform Code of Military Justice or other statutes?
Let's go to Nathan. Nathan's with us from Marlette, Michigan.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
My question is, you have mentioned that this possibly could go to a 4-4 decision. If that happens, what then happens to the case?
There are several issues at question, David Savage. So 4-4 split, what happens?
Well, the government would win. It would be a 4-4 split as a sort of no decision, and the court usually issues a one-line order that says the lower court opinion is affirmed by an equally divided court. And the lower court, the one that John Roberts sat on, basically upheld the president's authority. So basically it would mean that the Bush administration had won.
Would they win on all the issues? I mean, if they split 4-4 on all of the – I mean, for example, the jurisdiction case, the law at issue here was not even passed by Congress by the time when that lower court made its ruling.
Yes, I think it would be as though the Supreme Court never took the case. You know, the last ruling was that the president has this power. It's been upheld by the lower court. The as you say, the congressional action hadn't even happened yet.
Right.
But it would be as if the court never took the case and that the government's power to carry on these military commissions and try Mr. Hamdan had been affirmed.
Could there be a situation where you get different sets of votes, one on the jurisdiction issue, for example, and one on the substance of the issue?
Yes, they could say 5-3 that we have the jurisdiction to hear this case, but then on the merits we're split 4-4, so we'd be in the same place. Mm-hmm. But yes, they could divide differently on different questions. You would need a majority to say we have the jurisdiction to hear this, and then you need a majority to rule something.
We're talking with David Savage of the Los Angeles Times and with Scott Silliman, a professor of law at Duke University, about Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, which the Supreme Court heard earlier today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Brad. Brad's with us from Kansas City.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Conan.
Hi.
My question is regarding the Guantanamo prisoners in general, not necessarily Mr. Hamdan specifically. I was wondering about the basic issue is that these prisoners were picked up on the battlefield, and I was wondering, is there any evidence to suggest otherwise? Because I've encountered evidence in multiple places that some of these prisoners were not necessarily, in fact, picked up on the battlefield. I was wondering if that would have any influence on the Supreme Court.
And just as a reminder, I think there are some 490 men now at Guantanamo Bay, something I think I'm right about that. There are charges, I think, pending against 78, I think, in terms of the military tribunals. And Scott Silliman, I believe that Brad is correct. Not all of these prisoners were picked up on the battlefield. Many of them were, in fact, turned over by other people in Afghanistan. Some may have been picked up in Pakistan.
That's correct, Neil. And again, what Brad's talking about is the United States' argument that it can detain enemy combatants as long as the war on terrorism goes on. And the screening mechanism which the government has set up to deal with that is what's called the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. That's not really at issue directly in the case that the court heard this morning. That issue is awaiting a decision in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. But obviously there are related issues here. That court in the District of Columbia will probably wait to see what the Supreme Court does with regard to military commissions. But the question of can we detain them for as long as the war goes on is really a different question, that if we can prove a violation of the law of war rather than just that they were enemy combatants, can we prosecute them in a military commission in a criminal type of proceeding, and what procedures must we use to do that?
Brad, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. David Savage, I guess we have seen a succession of these cases come before the court since these men were first captured, some involving American citizens, people who are being held in this country, in this case, Mr. Hamdan. This is going to be going through the courts for years, it seems safe to say.
Yes, there are quite a few cases coming along. I think in regard to the last call, we don't really know the answer to the question of who are these men who are being held at Guantanamo. There's really not been a very good public accounting of that. There's a Seton Hall law professor who did a sort of an analysis based on the government's own interviews with these men and says something like only 5% were picked up by American troops. Most of them, as you said, Neil, were handed over by Pakistanis or whatever, sometimes for a bounty. Very few of them were actually found on the battlefield. Don Rumsfeld said early on, these are the worst of the worst, and it created the image that these were really hardcore terrorists. I don't think there's a lot of independent evidence to say one way or another as to who these 400 or 500 men are. How were they really big fish and really terrorists, really al-Qaeda fighters, or were they people who happened to be foreign Arab men in Afghanistan when the Pakistani troops and American troops said, we want to round up foreigners who are here in Afghanistan? So I think it's a long ways to go before we have a real accounting as to who are the people being held at Guantanamo.
And Scott Silliman, yes, these hundreds of men being held at Guantanamo, they are all men, by the way. But then there is another category of prisoners, al-Qaeda seniors, who are being held, we don't know where, under what conditions, we don't know, and we don't know if they're ever going to be charged with anything.
That's correct, Neil, because the Supreme Court's decision of a year and a half ago, which started all this going as far as giving these detainees at Guantanamo Bay some access to our federal courts, does not include anyone held outside of Guantanamo Bay. They are in a legal limbo right now. But you mentioned American citizens. Your listeners need to know we are still waiting to see whether the Supreme Court will grant cert in another major case, which is Jose Padilla, and whether he could have been held in military confinement without access to a lawyer, without being charged, for almost 4 years. That case is still pending in the Supreme Court's docket. That's another big case. We need decisions in both of them.
His case, the government said they were, in fact, going to try him in a criminal court in Florida, thereby saying the case before the Supreme Court was moot and shouldn't come up, and the Supreme Court has yet to decide whether to look into the case or not.
That's exactly correct, Neil. So we've got an awful lot of big issues in the war on terrorism, the president's authority, what he can do, waiting for the Supreme Court to act in Padilla case, one way or the other, or to decide in the case we heard this morning.
Scott Silliman, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Neil.
Scott Silliman, a professor of law at Duke University, former lawyer with the Air Force, with us from a studio on the Duke University campus in Durham, North Carolina. David Savage of the Los Angeles Times, their Supreme Court correspondent, was with us here in Studio 3A. David, as always, great thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.